Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Temple. John Temple is an associate professor of journalism and associate dean at West Virginia University. He's the author of Dead House, Life in a Coroner's Office, and he'll be reading tonight from his book, The Last Lawyer, published by University Press of Mississippi. Hi, John. Welcome to Prosody.
Thanks, Ellen.
How about you start off with some reading?
Sure. This is from the very beginning of the book. It's set at the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchman, June 21st, 1989. The roads around Parchman Farm run straight as the flight of a bullet. Even at 60 miles per hour, the flat cotton fields of the Mississippi Delta stretch motionless in the distance. Clusters of convicts in bright white jumpsuits and red caps work the fields, hose swinging up and chopping down in ragged tandem. Over the rush of wind come snatches of a baritone work song or the bark of an order from a white-hat guard slouched in his saddle, a .45 on his hip. Ken Rose had made the long drive from Jackson to the penitentiary work farm in Parchman dozens of times over the previous 5 years, often picking up a bucket of fried chicken along the way to share with a client. The young lawyer had spent untold hours in the visiting room, hunching slightly to peer through the shoebox-sized hole in the metal grate. Sometimes he played chess with a privileged inmate on one of the benches in the scorching penitentiary yard. Or, if the client wanted to stretch his legs, they'd play one-on-one on the hard-packed red dirt basketball court with its lone hoop and chain-link fences topped with barbed wire. The basketball court was on the same side of C-tier as the death house. The small square annex topped with a tall white chimney had been used only three times since 1964, so rarely that the penitentiary officers ran numerous mock gassings before each execution, fretting that they'd slip up during the real thing and kill themselves. During some test runs, they would put a wild rabbit from the cotton fields in the chamber just to make sure the gas was working. The gas chamber itself, built in 1954, was an odd contraption, a six-sided metal pod that looked like an antique from a NASA museum, all silver rivets and long windows. It was built into a wall so that half of the chamber protruded into the room where witnesses sat. The other half opened into an operations room where the guards mixed the lethal blend of chemicals. On this balmy summer night in 1989, Ken entered the witness room of the death house. Rows of metal folding chairs sat on risers, and Ken took a seat near Leo Edwards's daughter and mother. Black drapes covered the gas chamber windows, but the audience could hear guards moving around inside.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Temple, reading from his book, The Last Lawyer. So, John, how did... I think the first question I think of is, how did this project start? And I mean that not just from the sense of how did you find these people, but how did you become interested as a nonfiction writer, a journalist in this subject?
Well, about 10 years ago, my memory is that I read a really short newspaper clipping about a team of lawyers who were flying from, I think it was D.C. to Texas. I didn't save the clip, so I don't know all this for sure. And they were flying to Texas in sort of a last minute attempt to take on an inmate's case who was about to face execution. And it had never occurred to me that people did this. That people, I don't know why that hadn't occurred to me, but it. I thought, wow, this is what must that be like to be responsible to take on that responsibility for trying to prevent someone from being executed. And, you know, I have lots of ideas that are interesting to me, you know, as a writer. But that's one that sort of stuck in my head. And when I finished my first book, I thought to myself, I started thinking about other subjects that I might write about. And I thought, you know, the one idea that sort of persistently stuck with me over the years is the idea of what would it be like to do that kind of law. Mm-hmm. And I began looking into it, and it just is – it's an area that there's obvious dramatic potential there, you know, for a,
sure.
for a book. There's an obvious story, you know, in these people's lives. And the kind of work they do is doesn't have a lot of rewards. And I thought this is a place where I'm going to find some really unique people, and I did.
Sure. The way you depict Ken Rose, who's the head lawyer that we kind of follow throughout the book, he seems like he's – even his colleagues describe him as this very kind of private guy, yes. you know, the still waters running deep kind of metaphor. And so I'm wondering when – how did you get him to agree to be the subject of a story, his work?
It wasn't something that came naturally to him at all. It was a bit of a process. He's not an attention seeker, but he's the opposite of being an attention seeker. But the other thing about Ken Rose is that everything he does in his career is geared around what he thinks is going to be best for his clients. So all his decisions are made with that in mind, more so than anyone I've ever met. He's selfless in that way. And so once he decided that this book could be good for his clients and for his cause, that's
what opened the door.
That's what opened the door. But it took some time, and it took about 6 months of talking to him and visiting with him to get to that point.
Sure. And how was this particular case picked? Did he pick it? Did you pick it?
Well, I went and spent several days with Ken, and originally, because he was the head of this he's sort of the center of capital post-conviction work in North Carolina, because he was the executive director of this law firm that exclusively represents death row inmates and then consults with everyone else who represents death row inmates. So he really was my guide into this world in North Carolina. So that's why, you know, he was the first person I contacted, but we weren't originally talking about me following a case of his or following him or building the book around him. But after several days of talking and him introducing me to other people, I hadn't really found a person or a case that I thought was quite right. Ken said to me one night, well, you know, I have this case, and I could tell right that, you know, he doesn't say anything without sort of thinking it over, that he was becoming amenable to the idea of maybe being, you know, a bigger part of the book.
Well, I was just thinking, like, was this just the case he was working on at the time, or did he?
He had about seven or eight cases going on at the time, but this case, the timing. Part of it was the timing, because these cases can – I didn't want to take on a case that was at the very beginning of the process, because
it could take forever,
20 years to resolve. But it also had to do with the nature of the case and the fact that it was a case that sort of was representative of so many of the issues of you know, that are problems in capital punishment.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because it does – you know, at first I thought, oh, you know, it was kind of like a jackpot that you hit this case that had all these themes in it. And then the more I read and the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, some of these themes about race and mental health and representation, all of that, they're probably indicative of most cases or are an influence in a lot of cases of capital punishment.
Yeah, the way Ken put it was that you know, this it was representative of all the of other cases and of the issues of capital law, but it the thing that separated that sort of distinguishes this case is that there were just so many of these issues cropping up in it.
Right, it's kind of a perfect storm in that regard.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Temple, reading from his book *The Last Lawyer*. John, would you read some more for us?
Sure. This section is a scene where Ken Rose, the main character of the book, and the lead investigator in the case are taking a trip together to visit the lawyer who had represented Bo Jones in the initial trial in which he was found guilty. So it's an important early interview in the case, that in their investigation of the case. Graham Phillips is the key, Ken told Sarah a week later. The old attorney probably wouldn't come out and admit that he had botched Bo's defense, Ken said, but there were always flaws and omissions. It was a matter of documenting enough of them to convince a judge that the trial was unfair. The first interview with Bo's trial counsel would be a crucial and complex negotiation, and that's why Ken was riding along today. Duplin County was an easy 2-hour drive from Durham and good terrain for conversation. The Piedmont foothills fell behind them, and the landscape flattened into tobacco fields separated by fringes of pine forest. They took Interstate 40, which in the summer was full of families driving to the Carolina beaches from the Raleigh suburbs. But it was winter, and a rare snow had briefly powdered the fields earlier in the morning, though the dusting was already gone and the air was warming. The skies cleared as they drove southeast. Ken told Sarah that most trial attorneys were understandably defensive when appeals lawyers started poking around looking for weaknesses in their defense of a client. Some almost seemed to switch sides, signing prosecution-friendly affidavits and turning over their files before the post-conviction attorneys had a chance to look at them. Other attorneys wanted to do everything they could to help their former clients avoid execution, even if they were portrayed as bad lawyers in the appeals. The key to sensitive interviews, Ken had found, was to ask the questions in a direct, non-judgmental manner. Just ask what the lawyer did and didn't do, he told Sarah. Everyone knew that judgments would be made later, but keeping confrontational interviews from disintegrating was an art, one that Ken had not mastered even after 17 years on the job. Sarah had heard that Ken could be hard on people who hadn't done the work the way he thought it ought to be done. And even though they'd gotten along well so far, she could see that capacity for sternness in him. He could be intimidating. Only the old hands at the CDPL were brave enough to tell Ken when he was giving them his implacable squint. You're giving me the West Point look again, they'd say, and Ken's easy smile would return. People at the CDPL chuckled when they thought of Ken at West Point. The crisp uniforms, the chain of command, the adherence to tradition, none of it seemed to fit Ken's approach to life. Ken had enrolled at the military academy after high school in New Orleans. It was the mid-1970s, and a career in the military was not a popular choice. Something about that had appealed to Ken, something about going against the grain, fighting the tide. From the first day at the academy, however, Ken realized he was a bad fit. He couldn't do anything right, couldn't polish his boots to the proper gleam or make his appointments on time. He spent many hours on punishment, marching back and forth in the square. He stuck it out for 2 years, not willing to forego the challenge, but then quit just before he would have had to make a 5-year commitment to the Army. Sarah couldn't imagine her boss in the military. This was the second long car trip she had taken with him, after their trip 6 months earlier to talk to Ricky Lee Sanderson's brother. Since Ricky's death, Sarah had let her close-cropped brown hair grow out. She had no time to go to a stylist, or maybe she had just lost interest in keeping up appearances. Instead, she'd spent many hours chronicling her experience with Ricky, writing about the case, their conversations, his theology, the night of his death. After Ricky's execution, Ken had asked Sarah what she needed, and she said that she wanted time to write about Ricky. Ken gave Sarah a few days off, and she'd filled 40 pages on her computer with single-spaced recollections about Ricky and his death.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Temple, reading from his book, The Last Lawyer. So, John, I want to ask a question about kind of the writing side of it all instead of the story and the research side, which I think sometimes can take a lead. Sure. When you're doing nonfiction and kind of journalistic writing. So, for example, in that section, when you're talking about Sarah and those memories of how she let her hair grow out and how it was different for her, One of the things I appreciated in the author's note at the end of the book is you kind of documenting the meticulous kind of rigor you took in order to make sure that you were trying to make it about their story, not about you inventing anything. You know, there's been a lot of kind of chatter about that recently in creative nonfiction. But, you know, in the same time, you have to be a writer and you have to create characters and you have to frame them and you have to give them qualities that make readers like them and want to follow them. So I guess I'm just – how did you think that through? Like did you think about the story and then go back and check? Or, you know, another point I was thinking of is very early in the book, Beau's sister is seeing him walk in the room and thinking about, like, his clothes and how they humanize him. And just even the fact that she's there, she becomes kind of us watching and his family watching. I'm just thinking about all those kind of things, like how you balance story with information, with fact-checking, all of that.
I think, you know, that's a big question and something that, you know, I've spent many years thinking and working on.
Sure.
And, you know, I read a lot of nonfiction and fiction and everything. And one of the problems that I see in nonfiction is what, when I was a newspaper reporter, we called sort of the notebook dump syndrome, meaning that everything you wrote down in your notebook found its way into the story. And I think that, instead the approach that I try to take as a writer is, and you can't separate the reporting from the writing if you're doing rigorous, you know, nonfiction, meaning,
sure,
you know, there's nothing embellished. The approach I take is to gather as much information as I can and then use the most telling details to sort of make the case that I'm trying to make or portray the person or portray a scene in a certain light. So that takes trying to talk to everyone who was there, visiting the physical location of every scene, mm-hmm, looking back at archival documents and then taking maybe 1/10 of the details that you've gathered and trying to create a scene out of it. But there are way too many nonfiction books that are 100 or 200 pages too long, I think, because nonfiction writers don't think the same way about story and narrative and really story structure,
right,
and what a scene should be in the same way as fiction writers, because,
right,
fiction writers have spent their lives thinking about it, and nonfiction writers have spent their lives thinking about a lot of other things as well, I think.
Sure. You know? And I think there's always the, you know, the rigor that the nonfiction person has to have is, you know, with a fiction writer, you can just make up details. You know, you need something, mm-hmm, to happen, you can just make it up. Whereas nonfiction, you have to kind of work with the palette you've been given. So would you do things like, you know, I'm thinking about the depiction of Ken Rose at West Point. Would you, you know, kind of separate from the conversation about the case and what was going on, just kind of talk to him about his time there? I mean, how'd you get that kind of info?
Talk to him, read about West Point itself, talk to people who knew him, you know, during those earlier periods of his life. In many ways, particularly with Ken, who doesn't always have the greatest memory or the most sort of self-awareness in some ways, talking to other people was even more important than talking to him. But certainly you just use as many sources as you can.
Sure. Because I was also thinking, you know, for you coming in as with that kind of reporter mentality, you're very aware of your position with everyone. And I was thinking about more them, because you have to, in a way, become invisible and part of the team. You know, you also talk about in your notes that you made sure whoever they didn't want you to talk to, because maybe you would inadvertently reveal some information or something that you didn't. But did they, did they just get used to you being around? Was there always kind of we've got a third eye there kind of thing? How did that work?
Yeah, it's, you know, I've been doing this for a while, both as a newspaper reporter who concentrated on longer work and then with both of my books. And there's no sort of substitute for just spending time with people. And once you've spent a certain amount of time with them, you do just – they sort of forget, you know, that you're there and it just always happens that way. So it's interesting. However, you know, these are really smart, savvy people and they're under they have certain – you know, they think about things as lawyers think about things. So every once in a while they would think – I could just see the light click on and they'd think, yeah, I don't feel great about John being here for this, but we'd usually work our way through that.
Yeah. I can imagine because, I mean, there is so much at stake with right. the work that they're doing. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer John Temple. John, can you read a little bit more?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Okay. This is a scene where Sarah Sanders, who's the lead investigator in the case, is going to meet Bo Jones for the first time. That's the inmate who they're taking on his case. A little background about the scene. Sarah was sort of a rookie investigator and she had just finished her first case. And what had happened was she'd gotten very, very close to another inmate who had given up on his appeals and allowed himself to be executed. And that had just happened 13 days earlier at the same place where she's going to meet Bo. So it's weighing on her during this scene. Sitting in her car in the Central Prison parking lot, Sarah prayed, "Help me not hold it against them." She always prayed before entering the prison, often reciting words from Ephesians 6. "Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." She needed those words to shield herself against the pain and sadness of the place. Sarah was not easily overwhelmed, but she didn't want the sorrow to distract her from her job. Ricky had died here just 13 days earlier, though Sarah could not yet believe this fact, and she had a new prisoner to help, one who couldn't seem to help himself, from what Ken had told her. She made her way inside the prison and up to the visiting room. When she saw Bo Jones approaching, she prayed once again, the same prayer she'd offered before her first meeting with Ricky, "Help us connect." Bo sat, and Sarah introduced herself, aiming her words at the metal grate below the glass, raising her voice to make sure it got through. "I'm Sarah Sanders," she said. "I'm an investigator at the Center for Death Penalty Litigation." Bo Jones interrupted, his angry, rushed grunt distorted and faraway sounding through the grate. "What do you want from me?" Very different from Ricky. Sarah picked up the designation of counsel form and held it to the glass. She'd brought it with her along with a yellow legal pad and a pen. "I work with Ken Rose, your new attorney," Sarah said. "Ken needs to talk to your old attorneys. He hasn't been able to reach them recently. They have information that could help you. We would like you to notify them that they're not your attorneys any longer. That's what this form is for. If you sign it, they will not be your official attorneys any longer, and we can continue to represent you." "Where are they anyway?" Bo said. "Every attorney that's visited me has asked me to plead guilty. I'm not guilty, and I'll never confess or plea. I'm either going to walk out of here as a free man or I'm going to die here."
So, John, after spending a lot of time with these people and with this kind of case and, you know, doing all the research and the writing, did your thoughts about the legal system change? And if so, how?
I don't know that they changed. I didn't write this book to be an anti-death penalty book because there are a lot of books out there that serve that sort of role and that sort of have that sort of agenda. You know, most books about the death penalty are written, you know, from that sort of perspective. I wrote it because I was deeply interested in finding out why someone would do this for a living and why someone would take this much time and effort to help someone who most of society does not want to help, you know. That's the central question that was interesting to me.
And so what did you find out about that question? Why does somebody do this?
I don't know that I know the answer still. I think it is but I think it's different for each person. When I say I don't know the answer, I'm not sure I completely understand why Ken Rose does this, but it's clearly something that he was born with. Other people had different motives. One, it's a fascinating area to work in as a lawyer. Sarah, I think, is a very religious person. She had certain religious convictions guiding her through this process. Ken, on the other hand, is agnostic, and that's not a factor. But his sense of social justice and his desire to put himself between people who society has sort of left behind and protect them is that's what guides him.
Comes from somewhere else. Well, John, our time is up. Thanks so Great. Much for coming. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.